This is Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll find out the latest on a long-running battle in one county over its more than century-old courthouse. We'll learn about equine therapy. It's being used to help veterans in northern Illinois. COVID-19 is not going away anytime soon, and there's some concern about how it might impact the homeless this winter. A report is on the way. Maybe you have seasonal allergies that flare up this time of the year. So do a lot of folks who are more nervous because of COVID-19.
I feel like I'm walking on eggshells, just like anxious about how I'm feeling and what that actually looks like.
Those worries are also leading a lot of people to complain about COVID fatigue. We'll hear from a counselor about ways to combat it. And we'll learn how one state has taken a different approach to handling the coronavirus in nursing homes. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, equine therapy and how it can help veterans struggling with emotional problems. We'll find out how many school districts are failing to keep track of student arrests or referrals to law enforcement, even though it's a requirement. And as cold weather sets in, there are concerns about the homeless seeking shelter in the age of COVID-19. Those stories and more are on the way. More than 6 months into the pandemic, people are still worried that every little cough or sneeze could be COVID-19. Now add seasonal allergies and flu to the mix as we head into the fall and winter. And from Chicago, Kristen Schorsch reports, it's a nervous time.
Emma Davenport is on the Schaumburg High School golf team. She's been working on her swing at practice, but there's a lot more on her mind these days, like her pesky allergies. During golf season, really anything she does outside lately, they flare up.
It starts with like a junkiness in kind of my chest and a scratchy throat, and then it moves to my eyes are watering, my ears feel like they're plugged, and I have a headache, and then my nose starts running. It's really not a pretty picture.
In the back of her mind, Davenport says she's wondering, are these just her typical allergies, or is she getting the flu? Or worse, is she getting COVID-19?
I feel like I'm walking on eggshells, just like anxious about how I'm feeling and what that actually looks like.
This is what a lot of people are talking about. This anxiety, this fear of confusing what you might actually have as we head into fall and winter during a pandemic. The thing is, it's a guessing game. In north suburban Glenview, Carrie Radford's husband and five-year-old son have allergies.
It's on the top of our mind, like the minute somebody coughs or sneezes.
They don't call the doctor right away about whether they might have something worse, like COVID-19.
But it's definitely like, okay, just do you think I'm getting sick, or do you think it's just still allergies?
And then consider all the kids in daycare, in sports. Some are back in school. And every time those kids even get a cold, their parents might wonder, do they need to get tested for COVID-19? And can it be a cheek swab rather than a brain poke? Teresa Fraga in Chicago's Pilsen neighborhood on the west side is 77 years old and her husband is 84. That puts them at high risk of getting both the flu and COVID-19. Fraga said she got nervous recently after being interviewed outdoors near her home to be part of a mural.
When I came back inside and I said, oh my God, I stood out there a whole hour. And what if I start feeling, you know, cold, or I still feeling, runny nose or whatever?
She says she's really worried about the winter, about what she might actually have if she gets sick. She's already keeping her distance from relatives who live next door and across the alley. Doctors say this anxiety and confusion is understandable. After all, the symptoms for allergies, flu, and the coronavirus are so similar.
I always tell patients and employees, you need to listen to your body.
Dr. Jennifer Vargas is with Alivio Medical Center, which has health centers on the west and southwest sides.
If you're starting to feel something different, you generally have a history of allergies, but now you're having shortness of breath, which you never had before, or you're having body aches and muscle aches and fevers and chills, and we tell them, well, that doesn't sound like it's your typical allergy.
That's when she says it's time to call the doctor. But one of the things physicians say they can control is preventing people from getting the flu. They're pushing flu vaccinations, hoping to reduce at least one of the causes of those fevers. Even if they don't have flu shots in the office yet, they're already getting calls from eager patients. Dr. Paul Luning is with PCC Wellness, a group of health centers on the west side and in the western suburbs.
The last time I saw this kind of sort of demand to, for the flu vaccine was back when the swine flu, 10 years ago. Over that, people got very nervous.
Not everyone is clamoring for a flu shot. Luning says he has some patients who don't even want to discuss it. Maybe they're already beaten down, he says, by 6 months of anxiety over the coronavirus. And then there's another camp. Some patients don't think they need the flu shot because they're avoiding people anyway. Physicians stress that there are other ways to reduce the confusion in the months ahead. Try not to get sick in the first place. Besides getting a flu shot, wash your hands often. Stay 6 feet apart from people who aren't in your COVID-19 bubble. And wear a mask.
Kristen Schorsch with that report. Advocates for the homeless say they are relieved COVID-19 has not ripped through shelters and encampments in the Chicago region, as some thought it might. But as the winter nears, there is renewed worry about keeping those without homes safe. Mariah Wolfel has the story.
At the homeless encampment under a viaduct in Chicago's Northside Uptown neighborhood, Tom Gordon runs the show.
I'm considered a mayor down here, not a self-made. The people voted me in back in 2017 as mayor down here.
So when COVID hit, he and 19 others at the camp decided on a few rules. Number one, you've got to wear a mask while panhandling.
You don't know if the donor that's bringing you the money, if they got the virus. So you ain't wearing that mask, you gotta get off the corner. My rules. And that protects everybody down here.
Everyone at the camp is getting tested whenever possible. And so far, Gordon says no one under their bridge has tested positive. The impact of COVID-19 on the homeless population across the country has not been as devastating as some feared, according to reporting by the Associated Press. Here in Chicago, advocates say that's largely due to the work of people like Gordon, who are taking proper precautions, and to a grassroots coalition of volunteer doctors who organized in March.
I did not expect this effort to become as big as it has become.
Dr. Steve Rothschild of Rush Medical Center is one of the group's leaders. He says within a week, the effort grew from just a few people into a coalition that includes three city agencies, numerous hospitals, shelters, advocacy groups, and more.
You know, we worked with donors and with our students to distribute PPE to all the shelters. We created, the mobile testing unit.
They started testing at encampments and shelters. They and others pushed for the city to provide porta potties and sinks at encampments. They helped the city organize and open isolation hotels for the most vulnerable people. But while he's proud of the work the group has done so far, the winter is bringing new concerns.
We are anticipating that the number of homeless who will be seeking shelter may go up pretty rapidly over the next few months.
For several reasons, he says. One, because not everyone who is willing to sleep outside in the summer is going to be when the temperature drops.
The other piece of this, especially for people who are doubled up or vulnerably housed, is flu hasn't gone away. So the minute somebody starts coughing, whoever's housing them is going to say, you need to get out of here. I'm not keeping you in my house anymore. So I think the biggest issue is going to be evictions and poverty, but all of this is going to come together in a perfect storm.
Currently, the state of Illinois has banned landlords from evicting tenants. And though the governor has been extending it on a month-by-month basis, that ban is currently scheduled to expire in late October.
And we're expecting to see a surge in homelessness, especially if the eviction ban gets lifted.
Julie Dworkin is director of policy at the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless. She, like most everyone I spoke to, wasn't interested in talking about temporary solutions like more shelter beds or new tents for people sleeping outside.
I don't think that we want to focus on improving the quality of life for someone living on the street. I think we want people to not be on the street. And the only way to do that is to find resources to create permanent housing.
Back under the bridge in Uptown, that's a message some residents asked me to reiterate.
I mean, if there's anything that you could say to the city right now, what
give me housing.
Housing, please.
Housing, please. That's Sean Davis. He says COVID just adds to a long list of inevitable struggles he faces in homelessness. He's had anxiety about a string of stabbings that targeted homeless people in Chicago this year, and he himself got shot just a few months ago near his encampment.
The only thing that could really save everybody from an experience like me, you know what I'm saying? Because a lot of violence against homeless is going around, and basically homelessness could be cured with housing.
The city has started using money from the Federal Pandemic Assistance CARES Act to provide housing to the most vulnerable. That'll mean apartments for more than 1,000 homeless Chicagoans. But that funding will eventually expire. And advocates say a long-term solution to homelessness will require, in part, a long-term funding source. Mariah Wolfel, WBEZ News.
Nearly 7 months of coping with lives upended by the pandemic have left many people on edge. Tim Shelley of WCBU recently spoke with a counselor, Cody Maddock, about the roots of that fatigue and how people can better deal with it.
We are all feeling some COVID fatigue. We've been, whether it's quarantining, staying at home, wearing masks, social distancing, we've been doing this for months now. No end in sight right now. And for that long of a time period, definitely comes with its stress and it takes a toll, whether it's with following those health guidelines or maybe worrying about the possibility of contracting the virus or having a loved one who may test positive or be at risk. That worry definitely gonna cause fatigue.
What's the fatigue feel like? We've talked a little bit about how it happens, but how does it impact people, and what can I do potentially to stave it off or deal with it?
Yeah, I think people will find it'll impact them in different ways, very much like stress. Fatigue as in tiredness, literal fatigue would definitely be a common part of COVID fatigue. It could be increased anxiety, perhaps irritability over time. You know, chronic stress might impact how we are interacting with others, might rise in anger. Like I said, irritability that might impact relationships. And that kind of brings it back to ways to combat COVID fatigue is general and really good coping skills for stress, such as exercise, social connection. And I think that the connection piece is really important. I think a lot of us are socially plugged in, but lately maybe that connection has waned a little bit. So focusing on more meaningful connections with people rather than checking someone's Facebook, reach out to them and then have a conversation.
Why is it so important to, you know, maybe reach out to somebody and talk to them on the phone? Or I know our ability to get together, especially in large groups, is really limited right now. But why is it so important to try to form, you know, that type of connection rather than just send somebody a text or, you know, send them a Facebook message?
I think with the Facebook messaging, with texting, you know, Twitter, Snapchat, on and on, all those, they're great ways to kind of stay in touch and be aware of other people's lives, what they have going on. But we miss that deeper connection, and we may know that, you know, a friend of ours it went on a trip or maybe is having a rough time, but we don't know how that's impacting them in detail or how we can help. And reaching out and getting that more personal connection just helps us process all of the things that we're going through. When we look on social media, we of course see other people going through COVID fatigue, and we don't often get a chance to really process that information. When we talk to someone else, you're able to explore your thoughts a little more.
And I just wanted to return to something you had talked about a little bit earlier. You talked about people, you know, actually feeling physically fatigued, feeling tired, being irritable more easily. It seems like, based off of, you know, conversations I've had, people I've talked to in terms of how they're feeling, that seems very common right now. How do I begin to deal with that, I guess, those interpersonal connections that might become frayed by just the overall stress and tension right now?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think we're all seeing that in people we know. And like we know, it's not just COVID right now. There's natural disasters. There's protests and a lot of strong feelings about everything that's going on. And one thing that I think can be helpful is taking a step back and reminding ourselves this has been a stressful time for all of us. But if we are noticing that we're feeling more irritable, and maybe someone we're talking to, we're noticing that they just aren't quite themselves, or this is a more angry conversation than was intended, taking that step back and saying, well, this has been a very stressful year. It's possible that, this irritability or anger that we're seeing is an expression of just all of the stress, and being compassionate to each other. It's okay to feel irritable. That's part of this fatigue, this stress, and it gets the better of us all sometimes. And being able to step back and acknowledge that can be very helpful. In terms of helping to control our own irritability, I think it's really important to pay attention to the way we think, the way we talk to ourselves. If we promote thoughts that are negative or cause us stress or anger, then that's how we're going to feel. And so maybe if you notice you're walking into a store and put on a mask, and you become angry because you're putting on the mask, and ask yourself, what do you tell yourself about the mask, about putting it on? And is there another way that you might phrase that, if it, that's a more positive? So maybe, well, I'll get in and out, and I'll only have to wear the mask for a few minutes, or I'm wearing this mask to keep myself safe, to keep others safe. I'll be able to take it off when I leave the store. So trying to frame that a little more positive, looking forward, changing that narrative in your thoughts a little bit can really help with that irritability. We have been affected by COVID for the better part of this year, and will continue to be. I think finding the silver linings, finding a more optimistic way to process this information is going to be really important to combat COVID fatigue, and sometimes that can be difficult.
That's Counselor Cody Maddock discussing COVID fatigue, and he spoke with Tim Shelley. We have more to come on Statewide. An investigation found many school districts are not following the rules on certain reporting. We'll hear about that. It's next. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. An Illinois newsroom investigation has found multiple school districts across the state are not keeping track of student arrests or referrals to law enforcement. That's despite the fact that school districts are required to report arrests and law enforcement referrals for school-related incidents to the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights every other school year. Brian Moline talked with education reporter Lee Gaines about her findings.
Lee, first of all, how did you come to learn that schools were not tracking or in possession of data related to how many students are arrested each year?
There are discussions happening in communities around Illinois regarding the presence of police in schools. They're often referred to as school resource officers. And so a very simple question, or what I thought was a very simple question, was, well, how many students are getting arrested each year? So I FOIA'd about 24 school districts around the state, looking at populous school districts outside of the immediate Chicago area. And what I discovered was that most of them, 15 of the 24, are not tracking or are not in possession of records related to student arrests or referrals to law enforcement. What's crazy about that is that they are actually supposed to report that information to the federal government every other year. Important to note here, though, that they are not required to report that information to the state. And so what ended up happening is some districts would refer me to their local police departments, and then their police departments would deny it, or they also weren't tracking that information. It very quickly spiraled into a very messy data situation.
You focused on Champaign Unit 4 and Urbana District 116 schools. What did you find out about student arrests and referrals to law enforcement in those districts?
Champaign Unit 4 was reporting that zero students, so not a single student, was arrested for the 2013-14 school year, the 2015-16 school year, and the 2017-18 school year. Those are the years in which the federal government has collected this kind of data from school districts. And that contradicted the district's own data. So when I FOIA'd them, they sent me some board documents that showed that actually there were dozens of mostly Black students who were arrested during those school years. Urbana District 116, it was almost the opposite issue, where they responded to my FOIA request for student arrest and referral data with a relatively small number of arrests. But the data that they submitted to the federal government showed that a lot more students were arrested in the 2015-16 school year. 21, to be exact, 13 of whom were Black students, and another 30 were referred to law enforcement, and more than half of those were also Black students. So as you can see, it's hard to tell what data is accurate and what data is inaccurate here, and there doesn't seem to be consistency in reporting that information.
And Lee, why does this data matter?
I think it matters because you can't know what's happening to kids if you don't track this data. So you won't know if certain groups of children are more likely to interact with law enforcement and what the outcomes of those interactions are. My source from the ACLU of Pennsylvania says that in states where the data collection is more robust on this issue, in general, Black students with a disability, Black boys specifically, are the most likely of any group to be arrested. In general, students of color seem to be more likely to be arrested than white kids. And in schools with mostly white children, it's the poor white students who are more likely to be arrested. So this has huge implications for a student's trajectory, not just in their education, but in life. Once they get involved with the criminal justice system, it can be really hard to disentangle oneself from that system. And then it has all of these repercussions on their life moving forward. And as communities debate the value of SRO programs, the value of police in schools, at a bare minimum, I think we should have an understanding of who is getting arrested.
That's education reporter Lee Gaines. Her full investigation into student arrests at Illinois school districts is available online, and you can find a link at our website, statewideshow.com. Weeds have been growing around the old and empty courthouse in Rock Island. That's apparently all that's happened since the middle of the summer, when Illinois' 3rd District Appellate Court ruled the county cannot demolish the 123-year-old building without complying with the Illinois State Historic Resources Preservation Act. Michelle O'Neill reports, according to state law, the county board must consult with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources.
Attorney Thomas Quinn argued the case for the plaintiffs, preservationists, and residents who sued to stop the Rock Island County Board and its Public Building Commission from tearing down the historic courthouse. He's an associate at Jenner and Block in Chicago and took the case pro bono.
If a county project still requires a state agency permit like it does here, then that project isn't exempt from the Preservation Act, and you have to get sign-off from the state licensing agency, in this case EPA, and the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. So that was the thrust of the opinion.
3rd District Appellate Court Justice William Holdridge wrote the opinion at times using pointed language. For example, first, the Public Building Commission, or PBC, asked the Illinois DNR for input about the Historic Preservation Act, but then ignored it in clear violation of the law. The justice wrote that if appealed, the appellate court would have reversed a 2015 judgment by Henry County Judge Dana McReynolds. It was a test of whether the county could legally build an annex to the Criminal Justice Center.
It worked because there was no one really on the other side of that case because they were suing themselves. I think what the court in the Quo Warranto action held, that even though the law says you can't expand the purpose of a public building commission without approval of voters, what they were proposing to do was really just enhancing the purpose.
In Justice Holdridge's words, the circuit court's expansion of the PBC's purpose was particularly inappropriate because the board had already acknowledged that the PBC lacked the authority to build a new courthouse and because voters overwhelmingly rejected the expansion of the PBC's purpose.
But no one ever challenged that ruling. No one ever took an appeal of it. And so it sort of stayed in stone. And it ended up being the basis of why we didn't prevail 4 years later, because if it's already been determined that the Rock Island Public Building Commission has the authority to build a courthouse, which, you know, it has through this sort of sham lawsuit that was never challenged, then they logically have the authority to knock one down.
Plaintiff's attorney Quinn says now Rock Island County must comply with the Preservation Act and complete a consultation process with the state DNR and EPA.
The EPA and the IDNR are pretty much on the same page, and they've made a proposal to the county and to us that is pretty much identical to our original settlement proposal. They would like the county to undertake an RFP process to determine if there's anyone out there who's interested in reusing the building, either for private use or maybe rehabilitating it for county use. And if that RFP process fails, then they might be willing to consider alternative mitigation proposals from the county.
Richard Brunk, chair of the Rock Island County Board, says the county respects the appellate court's opinion, which he calls a split decision.
It simply mandates that we go through the process with the DNR to essentially ensure that that process is carried out and that there may be certain steps that need to be taken just to ensure the building is recorded, if you will, for historic posterity. The county remains committed to maintaining the course and doing what has been determined to be in the best interest of county operations and the taxpayers in the long run.
And that's demolition.
That, unfortunately, yes. That is maintaining that property for future county use, yes.
So far, the Illinois DNR has not responded to questions about the status of the mandatory consultation process. I'm Michelle O'Neill.
Across the Midwest and the country, many COVID-19 cases have been concentrated in nursing homes, and it's often the result of an outbreak, but sometimes it's actually by design. Paige Flager has this story.
In Ohio, the long-term care facility with the most known COVID cases is on Columbus's east side. It's called McNaughton Point and has had over 120 cases and counting. Operators declined requests for an interview, but a spokeswoman for McNaughton Point says the high number of cases is not due to an outbreak. Instead, they are voluntarily taking in COVID patients from nearby hospitals or other facilities. They created two units where patients and workers are kept segregated. Maureen Corcoran of Ohio Medicaid says this sort of arrangement sometimes is incentivized.
Because of COVID, we created a special designation that nursing homes could apply for that has higher reimbursement rates.
These designated facilities are called healthcare isolation centers, and they have bed capacity and specialized staff to take care of COVID patients. The higher Medicaid reimbursement helps ensure there are enough nursing home beds for people with COVID.
Maybe they were at home and they broke their hip, went to the hospital, but then found out that they had COVID, we knew that we would have a very difficult time finding somebody who would be willing to take them.
However, there are only 13 healthcare isolation centers in Ohio. McNaughton Point is not one of them, but it still stands to make money from the move by keeping their facility full. Corcoran says many nursing homes across the state have seen at least a 10% reduction in occupancy.
When we stopped doing a lot of surgery, it meant that nursing homes who were doing more of this kind of rehabilitative care experienced a bigger drop.
Pete Van Runkle of the Ohio Healthcare Association says facilities that voluntarily take on COVID patients need to be transparent with families.
The more you communicate and explain what's going on, the better that they understand, and the less that they're, thus likely they're going to, you know, think that there's something bad afoot.
He says family concerns about loved ones are only exacerbated by the lack of visitation at some facilities. And that's what sparked complaints from the daughter of one McNaughton Point resident.
No one was allowed in. No one was allowed in. I mean, they could have done anything. That's what makes me so upset.
Vicky Kidd's mom, Norma Ann Carter, was a resident at McNaughton Point. A spokeswoman for the facility says they kept families informed about admitting COVID-positive residents. But Kidd says it was difficult to get answers after her mom was diagnosed with COVID.
They told me that she had tested positive, so the next day I tried to get a hold of them to find out what they were doing. Well, I called and no one answered, no one answered.
Eventually, she got in touch with a nurse.
I said, well, is she having a hard time breathing? I said, how is she doing today? And they're like, no, she's holding her own. And then the very next day, I think she passed away.
Kid still doesn't know if her mom was ever put on a ventilator or transferred to a hospital for further care. McNaughton Point declined to comment on Carter's case. More than 24 people have died from COVID there since April. A spokeswoman for the facility says at least 75% of their cases were people admitted with COVID-19. However, the latest self-reported numbers from the CDC show about 50% of their case numbers are from admissions, which would mean the rest originated inside the facility. A spokeswoman declined to comment on the discrepancy. A written statement says the facility is doing everything they can to reduce the spread of disease while making sure COVID-positive seniors have a place to go. Paige Flager, Side Effects Public Media.
A year ago this week, the former Sangamon County Sheriff Wes Barr died of a heart attack, and it came as a shock to his family because he'd never showed symptoms of a heart problem. But later, his family realized they had missed a sign that something was wrong. I had a chance to speak with his wife, Sherry, who is using her husband's death to raise awareness and try to help others. Going back to that day, how did you find out about what happened?
He was at my nephew's shop, and he was cleaning his boat. My nephew was out with his crew on a job site. They had one of his employees had come back and found Wes, called 911, called my nephew, and my nephew called me.
He had had health concerns before, but not regarding the heart, correct? That was a surprise to you.
It was a total surprise. Wes was actually really healthy. He had high blood pressure, but he'd had it for years with never any issues or problems with it. As a matter of fact, he was on two medications. The doctor had taken him off of one because he was doing so well. He had gone to the dentist shortly after that. Our dentist takes blood pressure and said, hey, your blood pressure's a little high. And he said, okay. So he, of course, we just assumed that it was because we had just been taken off of one medication. So the doctor put him back on it, thought everything was fine, and shortly after, he had the heart attack.
There were some indicators, but you feel they were missed, correct?
Yeah. Afterwards, we thought about it. We were talking about, like, because everybody kept saying he had no signs. And I said, you know what? He did have. For about a month, he had indigestion. And we didn't realize that that was a sign. He was 56, and we just, you know, people around had indigestion. I actually had an incident where I thought, and he told me to go get it checked, and I went to get it checked, and it was indigestion. So when he got it, we just thought, oh, it's indigestion.
And what have the doctors, what have people told you since then regarding that?
Well, we've learned that indigestion is a sign, you know. We thought that it was really the other way around, that when you thought it was your heart, it was end up indigestion. We didn't realize that indigestion really was a sign that it is your heart.
He did not have anything like shortness of breath or, you know, chest pains, things like
that? Nothing. He had nothing. This was a complete shock.
I read where you had also, by promoting this, by talking to people that you know, encouraged others who were feeling similar symptoms to go and get checked out, and that proved to be fortuitous to them, apparently.
I had just been talking about Wes's head indigestion and that this is a sign, and I had been posting on my Facebook page and just telling people that this is a sign. So one of the guys is a dear friend of ours at the lake. And he went to work that day, and he thought, man, I got indigestion. He had a couple days, and he thought, you know, and he got to work, and he thought, you know what? I just don't feel right. I don't feel bad. But he said he remembered what happened to Wes, and he remembered me talking about indigestion. He turned around and went back to the hospital, and he had 90% blockage.
After your husband's passing, you decided to, you know, become more public about these types of symptoms, and then also you've decided to create a not-for-profit in his name.
I did. So, you know, Wes was so giving and caring, and he just loved this community so much, and he loved to volunteer and help people, and so he just left us way too soon, and I felt like it was my responsibility as his wife to keep his goodness going. I started the Heart of Wes Barr Foundation. I have a board of 12 of us total. Our goal is to raise money to help social service agencies law enforcement, veterans associations, and animal protection. We'll help them, and we'll try to keep as much as possible the money in Sangamon County as well.
What do you think his reaction to that would be? I mean, the fact that giving back to the community this way.
Wes would love that. I mean, that's just what Wes lived for, and he would love that. And I always say, you know, when I get to heaven, I want my Savior to say, well done, good and faithful servant. And I want my husband to say, I'm so proud of you.
That's Sherry Barr. Her husband, Wes, the former Sangamon County Sheriff, died of a heart attack a year ago this week. You can find out more about their nonprofit organization. A link is at our website at statewideshow.com. Just ahead on Statewide, helping veterans with equine therapy. You're listening to Statewide, and remember, our weekly podcast can be found through the NPR One app. Next weekend, horse riders with the Harvard, Illinois-based Bravehearts organization will ride 20 miles east from Bull Valley to Chicago. Those miles symbolize the number of veterans who die each day by suicide. Reporter Maureen McKinney spoke with Bravehearts president Megan Hill McQueeny and Palatine veteran Vince DeRay, who will make the Trail to Zero ride on October 11th.
Can you tell me about how equine therapy helps?
Physically, horses, when we sit astride, it challenges our core, our balance, our center. It challenges our thought process to partner well with the horses. Cognitively with horses, you know, whether it's maybe a child who, you know, might be challenged with being on the spectrum for autism, or maybe it's a veteran who is challenged with having a traumatic brain injury, you know, horses are very much routine, consistent, ritualistic animals. And so having things go step by step by step is very important to have success with horses. And I think that's great for individuals dealing with, you know, cognitive challenges. Emotionally, horses are almost a biofeedback loop. They say that, you know, they're a mirror to who we are. But the truth of the matter is, you know, I could put someone in a round pen with a horse. And, you know, to me, on the outside, if I say to this person, you know, how you doing today? And they say, hey, I am fine. And if I put them in the round pen and maybe they're really dealing with a lot of anxiety, that horse really, really becomes that anxiety. They really breathe that in, and they demonstrate that anxiety physically. The horse, you know, just from a person standing in the middle, and it might look like nothing is going on to me, the horse will respond and, you know, start to trot or run around that person just because they feel all that anxiety. They read all that energy. The horses pick up when our brains are busy. The horses' feet respond to that. They're so brilliant at reading intention. They're able to smell adrenaline, and they actually have the ability to sync their heart rate with ours, because in a herd of wild horses, in a herd of horses, that's what they do. The herd all acts the same. So if a mountain lion was crossing a pasture, and the lead horse was like, uh-oh, danger, all the other herd members would feel that and become that, and the herd would respond as a unit and immediately travel away from that predator. So in a round pen, back with humans and horses, we can help a person learn how to help the horse. In turn, it helps that person do the same. And so horses are very much mindful animals. They require us to literally to be in the moment.
And Megan or Vince, can you tell me a story of a veteran who's been dealing with mental illness or suicidal issues that really made an impression?
Yeah, me. I was suicidal 3 times. The third time I was thinking about doing myself and my sons in. I have a strong faith base, so I always took myself into the emergency room when I needed help. I went through every program the VA had to offer me, anger management, learning how to cope, learning what my triggers were. I am bipolar. Finally, after I got this great psychiatrist, and after going through all the programs, she goes, Vince, I got another program. Would you like to try it? Now, you have to realize I'm showing up in boots and jeans and hat and, you know, dressed pretty much a cowboy. She goes, would you like to try equine therapy? And I sort of look at her over the top of my glasses like I would look at my sons when they misbehave, thinking to myself, I've been seeing you a year and a half, and now you tell me that there's a horse program? I was at Bravehearts the next day picking up the paperwork. I'm driving up maybe, oh, I would say 20 yards from the place, and I see the flag, and I see the sign, and I knew it was the sanctuary. I was riding within a week. I'm going to share with you my first retreat story, and it's with a Mustang called Velvet. Velvet was misbehaving that day in her stall. She wanted to be outside with the other, with the rest of the herd, and so she was kicking and stomping around and butting her head against the stall. So they decided to, like, give her a little chill section. We took her into the round pen. One of the veteran trainers who works with the Mustangs showed us how to lunge her, because I had only been there, like, about a month before I was able to do the first retreat. And he showed us how to make her go around in a circle one way, and then he told us you got to make her go around the other way because horses have their eyes on each side, so you have to make them go in 180 in one direction and 180 in the other direction, and then they get the full idea of what their area is like. So when it came up my turn, Jamie says, well, Vince, what do you want to work on? And I said, well, I am bipolar, and my sisters don't understand that I am okay. I want my sisters to trust me and work with me. I want this horse to trust me and work with me. So I got in the round pen with Velvet. For some reason, I went in and I just sort of like crouched down real low and just sort of chilled myself, got nice and calm. That's, you know, like four times your size, you know, is a little bit of anxiety there. So I calmed myself. And Velvet is just sort of like looking at me, you know, from a distance. I go up and I grab the lead rope, which is like about 6 feet long, something like that. Raised my arms and swung the end of the rope a little bit and got Velvet to move. That's what you want them to do. So I got her to move around about three times in one direction all the way around the pen, the whole 360. Then I got her to reverse again another three times. I have since learned that you don't push a horse if they do something three times in a row. You let them rest a little bit, and then they stop, and they chew, and they lick, and that's them processing what they just learned. So I stopped her after the second time around in the opposite direction, and I gave her a release, and she's licking and chewing. And again, I got down low and gave her a release. In other words, I let go of the rope and said, you're free. You can go do, you know, whatever you want to do, you know, we're done with the session. So Jamie said, hey, Vince, come over to, you know, to the edge of the round pen and tell us how you feel. What did you accomplish? And I said, well, what I accomplished was I got the horse to trust me and I got her to work with me. Just about this time, Velvet comes up behind me and she starts to chew on the top of my foot. Then she's rubbing her head up against my calf, and then my thigh, and then her head is in my butt, and she's raising me up in the air. The next thing I know, her head is over my shoulder. This is total trust, and I love telling this story. Every time I go up to Velvet, when she's in the paddock, she'll come up to me every single time to understand that I have the trust of something, of another one of God's creatures that trust me is totally amazing, because that's what I need in my life. I need trust. I need my Bravehearts trust me so much. In the short time I've been there, about a year and a half, they have allowed me to join the drill team and to go on my first Trail to Zero this past week, which was actually my second Trail to Zero, because last year I volunteered in Chicago. I was on the ground. And even on the ground, I had a tremendous experience. I was in Wrigleyville, And this man comes up to me and starts to talk to me. He's from Ireland, Ireland. And he's telling me about his best friend who does the same type therapy in Ireland with handicapped kids. Is that totally amazing? Like, wow. Wrigleyville, a tourist from Ireland, sees the Zero the Trail riding. He understands what's going on. A couple of minutes later, I see this man crying. I go up to him and I said, hey, man, what's going on? He says, I'm a vet, and this is totally moving. He was from New Jersey. And he said that his community lost like a whole platoon during Vietnam. This is how Braveheart touches people. This is how Trail to Zero touches people. I don't care if it's following the horses and picking up poop. I do not care. I am happy to do it. I also volunteered with the kids. And to be a sidewalker or a leader with the disabled kids and to see the joy of their face when they're riding is even more powerful than me riding myself. My goal is to become an instructor with the kids. Every time I see somebody and I take their vet, I'll go up to them and hand them a card. I am knowing myself. I'm blessed that I have the capability of knowing when I'm in trouble and taking myself in. But there are a lot of veterans that do not know that they can do that, that there is support out there. Braveheart is another tool in my toolbox to keep me happy and sane and to be around people that are supportive and energetic and enjoy life. If you're depressed, you can't be around people that bring you down. I have two torn tendons and a torn muscle in my leg, and I still ride. I'm on Winston, and all of a sudden, it's like somebody put a hot knife in my ankle. You think I could get Winston to move that night? That horse would not move a single inch for me. Not an inch, not a half an inch, not a quarter inch. That horse just sat there and looked at me. I could just see it in her eyes. She knew that something was wrong with me and would not move because she knew if she moved, it would hurt me more. That's how connected a horse can be to you. It's indescribably fantastic. You cannot lie to a horse. They will understand what is going on and with you even before you know what's going on. It is mutual respect with the horse, with the animal, with your fellow veterans. I wish that I would have known about them when they first got started. My life would have been completely different.
Can I ask, Megan, when you hear a story like that, it must be really gratifying to you.
You know, I think the horses do all the hard work. You know, the horses are, we call them our angels in fur. There's something, you know, really unique, extraordinary that God puts in a horse that it's just awesome to get to be, to get a first row view, you know, of getting to hear and see how much the horses do for so many people and in so many different situations. I really haven't seen a horse fail a person, whatever they're going through. People tell stories about like, oh, you know, that horse didn't want anything to do with me. It's funny because even those stories, you know, a month goes by and then that person, you know, might return to Braveheart and say, you know I was kind of at a spot in my life where I was kind of being a bit of a jerk, you know, and that horse told me that and nobody else would tell me that, you know. And so I just think there's so many lessons we can learn from the horses when we're truly honest with ourselves and allow, you know, ourselves to slow down and reflect, you know, on maybe what that animal's trying to communicate with us. If they want you in their herd, if they want you in their space, if that horse wants to be around you, if that horse, you know, naturally wants to pull towards you, then, you know, it's kind of a place in your life where you can be like, okay, I'm doing okay. I'm working on myself. I'm slowing my energy down. And there's times we all have our bad days where, you know, the horses might not want to have anything to do with us. And I think they're just so honest and they show us the truth. I think we have a lot to learn from them. I think that they can offer us a whole lot to
finding peace and wellness when we give the horses a chance. And yeah, it's awesome to get to see that. But quite honestly, I have the utmost faith in the horses. Like every time, we as people don't even know what's going on with somebody internally, but the horses really do.
That's Megan Hill McQueenie. She's the leader of Brave Hearts, an organization sponsoring an upcoming horse ride aimed to draw awareness to the issue of veteran suicide, along with Palatine veteran Vince DeRay, and they spoke with our reporter Maureen McKinney. That's it for Statewide this week. Don't forget to join us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Follow us on Facebook and check our website, statewideshow.com. Our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.